In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss MicroConf Europe 2014 and Dan and Ian's DCBKK. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 210. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, Mike? Haven't seen you in a while.
Welcome back. You know, I feel like there should be like fireworks and balloons and kazoos and stuff like that.
Thanks.
Welcome back on the show.
So it's been, what, four or five episodes at least since I've been on. And you and I hung out last week at MicroConf Europe. But what else has gone on that folks might want to hear about?
There was some interest in, shown on Twitter about this, but I had mentioned that I had let go a couple of developers. It was Friday. I was at the airport, and it was like 9 o'clock at night. I was at the end of my rope, and I just had it. And I was just like, all right, that's it. Both of these guys are done. And I let go two developers. Somebody had commented a while back, and it just kind of rings in my brain, that said, nobody ever got fired too soon from a job. And nobody nobody says that, oh, you fired them too soon. It's always, hey, why didn't you do that sooner?
Right. Yeah, so, that's tough, man.
One of them had been having ongoing issues, just keeping his hours up, and I just kind of finally drew a line in the sand. And then the other one had only been brought on about 6 weeks before, but he was brought on to help finish off version 2.2. And basically, I gave him a three-week time frame, 3 weeks stretched into six, and after six, I just said, okay, that's it, we're done.
Yeah. So what are you going to do? Are you going to hire more? Are you going to step back into engineering?
Well, a little bit of both. I'm probably not going to hire, because my other developer actually was out on his honeymoon. I'm really happy with his progress on all the stuff that's been going on with Audit Shark. So what I wanted to do was, had he been there, I wouldn't have been in such a rush to get rid of these guys. But I was just like, well, I'm going to be at MicroConf for another week. These guys are not going to make any meaningful progress over the next week or so. So I may as well just draw the line in the sand and be done with it. This other guy was on his honeymoon for 2 or 3 weeks, and I couldn't hand things off to him. So things just kind of sat there for a little bit. But he just got back today, so hopefully I'll be able to send things his way, and then, you know, I'll be kind of free to do other things. I'm kind of working on some stuff now, just because I didn't know when he was getting back, but once I've got a couple of other things done, then I'll be handing stuff over to him, and hopefully he'll be able to take it from there.
Nice. So yeah, I've spent the last 5 weeks kind of on the road. I took the family, my two kids and a wife, went to Thailand for almost a month, and then I spoke at the end of that at Dan and Ian Tropical MBA, their DCBKK event, which was awesome. And then I flew to Prague. My wife and family flew home to California. All told, in Thailand, I was only involved in one high-speed motorcycle chase with the police, ending with them searching me for drugs, which they found none. And we only had one trip to the hospital for stitches in my four-year-old's finger. But other than that, just your standard run-of-the-mill vacation.
The high-speed chase that you've alluded to, you downplay that very well right now.
Being on the road anywhere, it kind of makes you appreciate high-speed internet and having access to a washer-dryer, especially when there's four of us and we have like three changes of clothes each, so we all fit in a single backpack. But that was really the only things that I missed. The real kicker was this high-speed internet and not being able to predict how fast it would be at the next place. And you have no idea how much you rely on this. Like, we rely on it for our TV, for our movies, for my podcast. Like, I had a tough time keeping up with the podcast because sometimes I'd go to download them and it would take hours to download all the episodes. So it's good to be back at a place that where that's more reliable. And definitely if I was going to stay somewhere longer, like once I got to Prague, I was in an Airbnb for several days and the internet there was fast. And so it's not a matter of being in the US or not. It's a matter of like being at hotels or not. The high-speed internet is crazy. Critical. So the good news for me is Drip had its best single month of growth ever while I was gone, which is encouraging me to take more vacations internationally. But obviously the seeds of that growth were sown in the months prior to the travel, not actually while I was away. And I can see the trial funnel and how it all plays out. So I know that it was basically the 30 to 60 days prior to leaving, but it does make a nice punchline. People in Prague were asking how Drip was doing, and I was able to say it's actually doing really well. It's been growing really well while I'm on the road. So it's nice to be able to say that. It actually makes vacation a lot more enjoyable for me, because if things are tanking and they're going sideways and I'm on vacation, I kind of stress about it the whole time. And I'm thinking about how can I turn this around? What do I need to do? But if they're doing well, I can then be freed up mentally to be like, I just want to do more of the same. You know, when I get back, I'm really amped up to work and to continue to drive trials, which is essentially what I did when my family left and went back to California. I had 4 days in Thailand at the end, And I basically went to a co-working space in Bangkok, just worked long, long hours. Like I worked probably 12 to 14 hour days. And it was really worth it. Like I got a ton done and I was super fired up because I had been off for so long. You know, you get like reinvigorated when you step away from work that long and you get new ideas. You just kind of want to get back to it after a certain point. And that's how I felt.
I felt the same way just coming back from MicroConf, because I was putting in all this time on AudioShark before I left. And then for several days, I didn't get any work at all done on it. And then, of course, I come back and it's just suddenly I'm ready to get a lot of work done. And I've been very, very productive over the past several days. But I think part of that's also being able to kind of catch up on my sleep.
Yeah, it's always tough. And you're hanging out till 1 or 2 in the morning with everybody.
Yep.
Yeah. What's up with you and AudioShark?
I'm looking at different ways I can kind of scale up the sales side of AudioShark and decrease the length of the sales cycle. Those are two things that I'm kind of fighting with right now. One is the length of the sales cycle, and the other one is just generating enough leads that I can talk to on a regular basis. I mean, I feel like PipeDrive is kind of filling up with a bunch of different leads that are in there, but keeping track of them and keeping on top of everything and also trying to fill the funnel with people as other ones are kind of falling out. I think the big issue is that, I guess I'll say the broader picture, if I'm putting 100 people a day kind of into the sales funnel to try and follow up on, whether I'm actually contacting them or not is kind of a different story. But if I'm hitting them on day one and then I go to a second batch of people on day two, day three, day four, etc., by the end of a week, I've got 500 people kind of in queue. And some of them are just not going to be a fit. So they fall out very, very quickly. But then there's other ones where you've tried to reach them and they stay in your funnel because you haven't gotten a no yet. So they stay there and it's like you have to come back to them later on. And that's actually pretty challenging to kind of make sure that you're staying on top of all of them. And I don't feel like I have got a great system for that. Somebody actually suggested just using a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes that's the best solution, you know? The 100 a day sounds like a pretty high volume, though. That'd be tough to manage in software. That's a lot of leads or suspects or whatever you want to call them coming through.
Suspects. I like that word.
Yeah, I read that in a...
Victims, maybe?
In a sales book, yeah. So similarly, I'm also kind of ramping stuff up. I'm basically formulating 2 game plans for Drip for the next 70 days, and that basically takes me through mid-January, because you know the next 2 months is a lot. There's more holiday time. Things are kind of starting to wind down. I know that I can still drive trials and grow a little bit, but it's not going to be at the levels that it has been. So I know that these next 2 months are going to need a nice roadmap, and it's going to be doing some stuff internally, I think. So I'm working on a product roadmap and a marketing calendar. And the product roadmap is basically what features are we going to build? What are the next steps? Like after coming back from MicroConf Europe, I have some ideas after talking to a bunch of people about what they're looking for. I really got a good sense of where I want to take Drip next. And then in terms of a marketing calendar, I just want to know what's going on every week. And I'm really going to be buckling down on marketing because things have already started to scale up with Drip and I'm ready to kind of hit it even harder. So,
cool. This week, we're going to be talking about what happened at MicroConf Europe. We kicked off the conference with Rachel Andrew. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so we're just going to touch on a couple of the talks I think that we got the biggest takeaways from. Really, we only have time to go through a couple of the speakers. And Rachel Andrew, she really set the tone for the conference. And that was the goal, right? Typically, you're a kickoff speaker. You're hoping that they're doing something that's interesting enough that people are going to be really engaged and it kind of sets tone. If you're interested in more details about the speaker talks, as usual, we have a recap site. It's called MicroConf Europe Recap.com. We'll link it up in the show notes, but Christoph Engelhardt was so kind as to take very, very detailed notes, and he's aggregated slides and all types of stuff. We don't have videos of the talks, but that's the next best thing. You know, one thing I like about Rachel Andrew is she runs a CMS. It's called Perch, and she runs it with her husband, and they don't have any employees, and it's downloadable, self-hosted, web-based CMS. So it's really the traditional like kind of micro ISV micropreneur approach with no employees, and it's even downloadable software. So she has some really good experience. She's an experienced speaker, and she has a lot of takeaways that she lent to the crowd. And one of my favorites to kick us off was her quote, "The missing features at launch don't matter to anyone but you." And while I don't fully agree with that, because when I've launched specifically Drip, we had missing features and it mattered to everybody. But I think that depending on your product and depending on your competition and what features they have, this can go one way or the other. But I do like the sentiment of this because it reminds you that you are always going to be bothered by the stuff your product lacks, but that you need to ship it before you get to that comfort zone, or else you'll never ship it.
Yeah, I think when she was referring to that, what she really meant was that the things that you feel are important, your customers don't necessarily value as much. I mean, as long as you're meeting the core requirements of whatever it is that they need, that's the important piece. And that's why they're buying it. It's not as though you need to go out of your way to include everything in the kitchen sink. It's like there's this set of core requirements that your customers have, and that's what they're paying for. And all the other things that you think are necessary, they think are nice to haves, but are not critical for them to buy it. And I think that was a very fresh approach to that sort of thing. It's in some ways, it's kind of a minimum viable product sort of thing, but it was just a nice breath of fresh air to hear it put that way.
Another thing she said was that the happy majority of your customers will be silent. And this is something that I have definitely noticed with products that I own, but I hadn't thought about it in those terms before. And she basically said that, you know, a lot of features that you'll hear requested over and over are really just being requested by three or four people who are kind of your loud minority. And that a lot of your happy customers, really, you'll never hear from them. I think this is definitely helpful for folks who are kind of just launching a product to give them some perspective on what to expect as you're starting to deal with customers.
The phrase I've always heard is the squeaky wheels, you know, the people who are complaining a lot. And, you know, there's going to be a few of them, and they're going to complain a lot about certain things. But unless you hear a lot of people complaining about the same things, then you have to pay them a little bit less attention, because you can certainly go down the road of implementing things that, one, people don't use or don't need, or two, are going to actually hurt your product rather than help it, and make people a little bit more confused about what your product does.
Yeah, and I wouldn't, you know, you use the word complain. I don't know that I would use the word complain as much as, like, give feedback. Sometimes, like, the more irritating customers, they are complaining, right? And they're kind of a pain in the ass. But a lot of the customers who are in the unsilent minority are the people who I think genuinely want the product to be better. I think the majority of those folks, while they may email you feature requests three times a week, I wouldn't consider that a bad thing. I know it's hard to kind of deal with the onslaught of incoming feature requests. Of all people right now, I know this. I think we receive literally multiple feature requests per day for Drip. And so it's trying to get back to everybody and handle it well is a challenge. But I think I'm pretty thankful in general for even the people who send us one or two per week. If they're cool with realizing that we're not going to build all of them, I mean, I think that's where you get into the sticking point, right? Is if someone requests something and they're nice about it and you can't build it, sometimes that has to get done. And certain people are willing to accept that. And then certain people will get really indignant about it. And they'll say things like, well, you would get so many more customers if you had this. And that's pretty few and far between, though.
One of the things that she had mentioned in her talk was that the things that your customers tell you that they love should be in your headlines. And I thought that was not just an interesting take on it, but a fascinating way to kind of resonate with your audience, because your audience clearly is going to think about your product differently than you are. In some ways, it reminded me of other techniques I've heard from people, like going to Amazon.com reviews and pulling snippets of what people are saying about other products or about similar products and using that to help do SEO or to identify keywords that people are using to describe that type of product. And it was just a very interesting way of taking your customers' words and using them to your advantage on your website and in your SEO to help resonate with the rest of the user base that has already obviously bought into whatever it is that you're selling.
Right. Yeah, I love this one. I mean, I'm such a proponent of learning the way that your customers and potential customers are talking and thinking about your product, right? Entering the conversation that's already going on in their head. Yeah, and most of the time when I sit down to write marketing or sales copy, I will try to go and actually read emails or read testimonials or somehow read something from my customers to start getting me in the mindset of how I should be talking about it. So I think this is a really good tip. Another thing Rachel said was that you can learn a lot from the misuse of your features. So basically, you'll launch a feature and you think everybody's going to use it a certain way. And then she gave an example of how some of her customers misused it. But what that really means is that they have another need. I've definitely seen this. And at first, you start thinking, people are screwing things up, right? They're not using this correctly. But if you look at it from this other perspective, it can actually lead to making your product better.
I think a nice reminder that she kind of threw out there for everyone is that your product is never done. So even if you've implemented a ton of things that were in line with your vision, there's always new requests that are going to come up. There's always new ways to use your product. And if your customers are coming up with new ways of using your product in their environment for new processes or new procedures as part of their daily workflows, then you have to look at those and say, okay, well, can I rework the product or can I reposition it in terms of the marketing to make it appeal to those types of people in a slightly different way. And it just says, I mean, the work's never done. There's never going to come a time where you can just sit back and say, the work on this is completely done.
Another really popular speaker who actually went last was Lars Lofgren, and he's in charge of growth for Kissmetrics. And he does a lot of work with their content marketing team. He runs a lot of split tests for them. He did an excellent session of teardowns at MicroConf Europe. But his talk was titled Unlocking the Four Gateways of Growth. And I really enjoyed this talk. My guess is it will be one of the top-rated talks. He had a great overview of, depending on the phase that your product is in, what metrics to look at, how to ask, how to build a better product, how to ask if it can grow, how to build a stable business model. Like, he kind of went through the four phases, really good stuff. One of the first things he talked about was when choosing metrics. He said you have to have metrics that you're measuring to figure out where you are and where you need to go, what you need to improve. And he says when choosing metrics, always ask, what is the biggest constraint right now? I feel like this is a really succinct way of basically saying when you are early on in your product, you just need data, right? You either need one-on-one customer interviews when you're doing customer development, or if you want to split test marketing copy, you need traffic, right? You need some data to say which one's going to perform better. And then when you get further on, maybe you're starting to scale up, you don't necessarily need as much data anymore now. You need a lot of people coming and you need to optimize your funnel. So I guess in a way you do need data, but you just need that data further and further down the line of your funnel as it gets better. So I really like this whole concept of thinking about what is the biggest constraint right now for your product growing and figuring out how to measure that and then focusing on that for kind of a 3-month sprint.
Well, I think one of the things that that does for you is if you're trying to fix all these different things all at once, it can be hard to fix any of them effectively. And if you focus on the one biggest problem that you have, and let's say that you're having problems getting people to click through and actually sign up for a trial, and that's your biggest problem at this point, then by focusing on that and alleviating that headache as much as you possibly can, then you've essentially freed up people to move through the rest of the funnel. And then you get to see what's going on. And you don't necessarily know whether or not there are other problems that are right after that or are 6, 7, 8 steps down the road. By focusing on that one biggest problem, you're always focused on the biggest problem, getting those people through the sales cycle. And it trickles down.
Yeah. And I also like that this makes you think about, depending on your stage, you need to look at different metrics. Because we've gotten questions in the past where someone says, well, I only get 100 unique visitors per month to my website. How can I run split tests? And the answer is, you can't, because that's not your biggest constraint right now, right? You need to choose a metric that is actually helpful. And it's more than likely that you need to actually go and talk individually to customers and decide on what you need to build. But maybe your biggest constraint, if you only have 100 uniques per month, is that it's traffic, right? So then you can start trying to increase uniques and you can improve that. So I'd recommend definitely checking Lars's slides out there up on Christoph's hub. Another thing I like that Lars talked about is he had this section called Can You Grow? And the takeaway I took from that is he said, pick one growth channel, one marketing channel, and focus on it for a 3-month sprint and put everything you have into it and try to make it work. This is something that I have done many, many times. I've never systematized it like he was talking about, basically making it a sprint and making it official and documenting stuff.
One thing I like that Lars talked about was talking about whether or not you had a stable business model. And I think that's one of those things that's kind of neglected by most people because they're so focused on trying to figure out what should I charge. And not to say that what you should charge doesn't factor into it, but they're focused on all the details of trying to get people to pay for it and not necessarily focused on the big picture. And he talked about a couple of different pricing models. One of them was for SaaS. And he basically said that for SaaS, you want a lifetime value of a customer to be essentially at least 3 times your cost of acquisition. And you want to be able to recover that acquisition cost within 12 months. And if you're able to do that, you can establish a solid growth engine for that product. And if your churn is above 2%, then that's something else you need to work on, is to help drive that churn down below 2%. And obviously you get that by talking to customers. But I think that the figuring out what your cost of acquisition is and measuring it against what your lifetime value is really important. I think the one difficult thing is trying to figure out what your lifetime value is when you don't have enough data to figure that out. I was talking to Yana, who runs happybootstrapper.com, but she has a product called firstofficer.io. And we were talking about, how do you measure lifetime value of customers, especially when you have people who are paying you on a monthly basis versus others who are paying you on a yearly basis. And of course, the question comes up, you know, those people who are paying you on an annual basis, they only have one real opportunity to cancel, you know, and they're given that opportunity to renew every year. But that's kind of when they think about, do I want to renew this, versus the people who are getting a bill every single month. And they look at it and they say, well, do I want to keep paying this or do I want to cancel? There's obviously a difference between your lifetime value for the people who are paying you on an annual basis versus the people who are paying you on a monthly basis. And you can't just arbitrarily aggregate them together. That's not sound math. Mathematics. So we had a pretty extensive conversation about that. And it's just interesting how different people look at that particular problem.
Right. I think it's like trying to find the standard. And the standard I've seen is, if someone does not have the option to cancel that month, then they should not be included in the churn calculation. You can break up into annual and monthly churn, or you can say on the month that they were able to cancel, did they churn? To be honest, man, it's really hard, you know, to get below a churn of 2%. Like, it's pretty rare that that happens, but that's what the really big companies, when they really start to scale up, that's what they have to hit. So I like that Lars brought that out and brought some real numbers. These are numbers that I have either found myself or have researched and always keep kind of in my notebook, and they're my rules of thumb for things. And it was nice to see them up there on the screen for kind of everybody to see and to kind of benchmark their own apps from that. So as I said, you know, we had 9 speakers at MicroConf Europe. We can't talk about all of their stuff, but I'd recommend you check out microconfeuroperecap.com if you want to see some of the other talks about hiring a designer as a founder, how to build an app that you can sell, you know, optimizing SaaS apps. There's a lot of good info there. I really wanted to talk just for a few minutes about Dan and Ian's DCBKK event, which is DC is their membership website, their membership community. It's called Dynamite Circle, and BKK is the airport code for Bangkok. So it's a annual conference that they host for digital nomads. And I really consider kind of the Tropical MBA as kind of a sister podcast of ours. And to be honest, they have a lot of overlap. Like, their audience and the folks who attended may have the most overlap with MicroConf attendees in terms of their interests, and the conference in terms of its audience and its size and the format and everything. So it was really cool to get an inside look at how another conference for similar audience and a similar size was run. The fun part was that a lot of the attendees listened to our podcast, and it was really fun to touch base with them, since we typically wouldn't cross paths with them because they're digital nomads. So they're traveling in Southeast Asia and other parts of the world. But it was fun when I first got up to speak and they did a show of hands of who listens to our show. Kind of felt like it was a hometown crowd.
Really? How many? What was the rough percentage?
I think it was maybe 40%, 50%. It was a good chunk. That's my memory. Someone can correct me in the comments if I'm wrong, but I just remember thinking like, wow, yeah, a lot of people have heard of what I've been up to or have heard of the podcast. It was nice. And I kicked off the conference, and it was fun to do that. Well, one thing I did in my talk was, you know, I've talked about this stair-step approach a bunch of times on the podcast, but I've never really fleshed that out. And so I really fleshed it out and dove into what I think the specifics are of how to stair-step your way up to recurring revenue, meaning starting with a smaller product that's typically a one-time sale and has a single marketing channel, and then kind of stepping up to multiple of those until you can buy out your own time and you own all of your time, and then stepping up to recurring revenue. And that really resonated with the DCBKK crowd. It was cool. I overheard several conversations later referencing it and saying, yeah, you know, my app is a step one business right now, and I'm hoping to get to step two. And that's a really good feeling for a speaker to like hear a concept that you've outlined be used by attendees so quickly.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And, you know, I also talked about it again at MicroConf Europe about a week later. So that's, again, in our recap if you want to hear more details about it. I think the last point I'll touch on, the event was very well run, and I was impressed with it. A lot of conferences I go to, now that we run a conference, when I attend conferences, I'm pretty picky about it, and I know I can tell when people are screwing up. You know, if you go to a venue after the conference and the music's too loud, I'm thinking to myself, rookie mistake, man. You know, we're not here to club. We're here to hang out and talk, right? And we learned that the first year when the music was too loud at one of our venues. I was impressed. You could tell Dan and Ian had done it before. As usual, the hallway track is one of my favorite parts. Like, breakfasts and dinners were probably my highlights. Actually, in the Tropical MBA episode 268, it's titled Getting More Out of Conferences, Breakfast is a Big Deal. And they talk a little bit about this. But one thing I did this year at both of these conferences, DCBKK and MicroConf Europe, is I was really intentional about seeking out specific people who I wanted to connect with. And I made sure that we had some one-on-one time. Typically, I will see people like Derek Sivers was at DCBKK or Nathan Berry was at MicroConf Europe, and I would see them in passing and I might catch up with them at a group event. But I've realized that time is not, it's tough to have an in-depth conversation at a group event like that, because you just wind up, especially as the organizer and a speaker, like you get mobbed, right? There's a lot of people that want to talk to you, and that's okay. But I realize you kind of have to have one-on-one time to do it. So I think that if you are attending conferences, that perhaps my number one recommendation, aside from being prepared to ask interesting questions and not just make small talk, my other recommendation is to look out for people that you really want to connect with and make sure that you are able to find some one-on-one time with them, hopefully over a meal, where you can really catch up and like deepen those relationships. Because in my opinion, that's really what attending these events is about.
Yeah, that comes down to kind of scoping out who else is going to be there and then scheduling that time either before you get there or while you're there. I mean, if you haven't had a chance to connect with them before the event, definitely make sure that you get on their radar and say, hey, you know, I'd really like to sit down and talk to you for a little while, and this is what I want to talk about. Or maybe you don't necessarily have a set agenda that you tell them about, but, you know, just get on the radar at least so that they know that you're trying to make time for them, so that hopefully they'll reciprocate and make time for you as well.
Yeah, so thanks to Dan and Ian for inviting me to speak, and congratulations to them on running a top-notch event. So, Mike, we've run 6 conferences now, 4 in Vegas and 2 in Europe. You feel like we're getting a little better at it?
A little bit. You know, it's interesting going back and forth between, you know, Europe and Vegas. And, you know, there's certain things that I think that we took for granted the first couple of years at MicroConf in Vegas, because we went over to Europe and, you know, obviously the crowd over there is different, but then we changed some things over there that I don't think we initially realized in the beginning that helped make us successful here in the U.S. So I think the biggest one that I saw was, for example, in the U.S., we chose to do it on Monday and Tuesday because it was primarily for cost reasons, and we never changed that and we never experimented with it. And then the first thing we did when we went to Europe was we had it on a weekend. It's interesting that I think that actually might have torpedoed things for us if we had done that in the U.S.
Yeah, that the quality of the attendee overall tends to be less on average, because it's more people who don't need to take off work and they're able to come. Maybe you'll wind up with a lot more beginners, I guess is what I'm trying to say. A lot more people who are just thinking about doing things. But if you do it during the week, you tend to have more people who are really serious about it, because if they have to not only pay for a ticket and pay to fly, but they have to take time off work, then they're probably pretty committed to this idea.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that I kind of noticed up front. It's just interesting to see different perspectives from around the world about what sorts of things that people have to deal with. And, you know, obviously there's this core set of problems that everyone has, but it's interesting to see that, you know, people from different countries deal with them in different ways. And there are certain laws that affect some people and don't affect other people. And, you know, it's a very mixed bag in terms of the periphery problems that people have to deal with.
Right.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforthestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.